Will you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Let's give a warm San Clemente welcome to tonight's 40-minute speaker, and that would be Jill H. from Newport Beach.
Thank you. Jordan doesn't feel so bad. My name is Jill Hennessy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jill.
I saw his face when he started to accidentally say my last name, and for me, from the moment I got into this program, I knew that I had to kind of come clean, and I never had a problem with people knowing that I was in the program, especially when I first got into the program. My sobriety date is February 5th, 1994, and because I really wanted this when I came in, I was really ready. I was at the jumping off place, like they talk about in the big book, and where I couldn't live with alcohol and I couldn't live without it. And it's funny because prior to 1994, like throughout the 80s, I think it's commercial. I don't know what institution it was, what hospital it was, but there would be every year at this time a commercial right after New Year's that would say, you know, this year I'm going to, you know, pay my truck off. This year I'm going to visit my family. This year I'm going to go on a vacation. This year I'm going to stop drinking. I don't know if any of you guys remember that commercial. And something like that, yeah. And I remember when I'd see that, I'd be going, oh, my God, that's all I want for this year. I just want to be able to stop drinking, you know. And I actually would, I wanted to win the lottery. Because, see, this is before, I had heard about 12-step programs, and I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how any of them worked. I didn't know that they were related. I just was, like, wanting to play the lottery so I could win the lottery so I could check into rehab, so I had money to go to rehab. And so that told me that I was at a place in my life where my own will, which had run my life, my whole life up until that point, was aligning with my spirit, as beat up as I was getting. I'm from D.C. I'm originally from St. Louis, and then I moved to D.C., Arlington, Virginia, when I was 11. And so I grew up right outside of D.C., and it was in the 70s, 75, 76, right when disco came out. This is part of my story, and I talk about this all the time because, I mean, I loved being a teenager on a fake ID, getting 86 out of nightclubs before I even was legally able to be there. In East Coast, downtown city, nightclubs and discotheques. And it was so funny because I was 15 years old. I always looked older. And I was introduced to Georgetown. I don't know if any of you guys have been in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. Have been in Georgetown? Okay. And that's a part of D.C. where that is just, you know, clubs and, you know, stores, and it's all the old row houses from George Washington's day, but now it's just the happening place to go, right? So I remember my neighbor, it was so easy to get a fake ID back then, and I remember my neighbor helped me get a fake ID. It didn't even look like a DMV or anything like that. It was just a fake ID. And there was this club called The Bayou, and it was running right next to underneath the Whitehurst Freeway in D.C. across from the Watergate, you know. And it was pretty dismal looking down there. And I remember I walked in to The Bayou that one night. I was 15 years old, and I saw a band playing, live band. And my whole family, my mom's side of the family is musical. The right side of my mother's side of the family is like six generations St. Louis showbiz. So my mother was in burlesque, my grandparents were in vaudeville, and then went on and on, like circuses and stuff like that. My dad's side of the family, they can't even whistle. So they can't. You can't even whistle. And I remember, going, I am home. I've heard that two times in my life, and the second time has to do with my sobriety. But when I walk into this bar, and I'm like 15 years old, and I go, oh my God, God. I'm looking around and the music and the drinking and everyone's having so much fun. And I'm like, I am home. Okay. And then, you know, I won't go into a full-on drunk log, but you can imagine what a 15-year-old girl who was 18 to drink there in D.C. and in Virginia, and like 21 in Maryland. But my mother was sick pretty much my whole life, and she was living in Georgetown University Hospital most of my teen years. And my God bless my father, you know, trying to hold everything together. And so he was with her. You know, most of the time going to work and with her. My brothers had moved out here, and man, I had a car. Too much permission for this alcoholic. I had too much permission to do stuff. And so I'm like 15, 16, 17, you know, every night going down to Georgetown and just dancing, and, you know, it was disco time and rock and all that. And I just, that environment, I loved that. I wanted to be in that environment. That was like my life. I said, this is it. This is for me. I just want to be. So I became a bartender. Okay, so I became a bartender at 18. And I'm a true, true bar room drinker. And I became a bartender at 18. And my mom passed away, and I moved out here. My brothers were out here. And so I moved out here with my brothers. And I was running, pulling a Geographic from, you know, running from the pain. And so I spent, gosh, till 1990, getting in a lot of trouble, having a lot of fun, and then it's just not working anymore, and getting in a lot of trouble. But I was doing music this whole time, all through till I got sober. When my brothers, they were out here doing music, and so I got to a place where I was just whatever it takes for me to get sober. So when I was talking earlier about I was getting beat up enough to where I was having small little spiritual awakenings. It talks about, you know, the alcoholic being full flight from reality. And I remember, and then we get moments of clarity. And for me, it was a lot of people kind of calling me on my stuff, saying things to me like, you know, Jill, you still drinking a lot? I had this friend who always, I talked to her like every 6 months on the phone. How you doing? Chit chat. We'd be, you know, shooting the stuff. And she's still drinking a lot. And I'd be like, no. I mean, I was like, how dare she say that to me? You know, how dare she? And all those little the jig is up. You know, I was getting that from lots of people. And I'm like, wow. Okay, I'm not fooling anybody anymore. So I got to a place where I knew that I was a heavy drinker, and it was okay to admit it. And I had no problem admitting that I was a heavy drinker. Just the alcoholic part was hard, because it was very core with me. So I had two professions, a bartender, and I was working in bands as a singer. So that's all I knew. I didn't go to college. I graduated from high school. I became a cocktail waitress and a bartender right after college, because that's what every good, you know. And, you know, who said it? Someone else. Bartenders don't become alcoholics because they're bartenders. They become bartenders because they're alcoholics or something like that. But anyway, well, that was my case. But I finally got to this place where I never dealt with the pain of my mother's death. I had gone through a divorce, through a very, you know, perfectly compatible, dysfunctional alcoholic marriage with another alcoholic. And that ended right when I got into sobriety. Which is no fun at all. I'm sure there's probably some people that have experienced that. You get sober and then you lose your marriage and you lose all that stuff. And you got to stay sober through that while pouring drinks, tending bar, in my case, and also working in nightclubs. But so anyway, I get this this, you know, moment of clarity where I know, oh shoot, I'm a goner. So I know that I'm an alcoholic. But the core with me is, how am I going to be able to, first of all, have any fun in life without drinking? How can I not drink? I have to drink, because I tried not to drink before on my own and it never worked. And this is how I make money. How am I going to be able to go into my areas of profession, into the workplaces, you know, and, you know, make money? So I had all these like scary excuses, okay? I'm too scared, so I can't get sober, right? Okay, I can't get sober. I got to make money. I'm going to be in there. There's no way you can be in a nightclub or in a restaurant as a sober alcoholic, you know. Well, my experience was that was my my experience. I don't recommend it for anybody if they don't feel comfortable with it, but I know there's been a lot of us that were in the entertainment or the restaurant business or catering or things, construction a lot of times, and we, you know, have to find ways to get around that profession and not drink but still be in it. And so it's funny because in the book it talks about how we can be anywhere where alcohol is once we are spiritually fit, and if we choose so and we have a legitimate reason to be there. And for the first 9 years of my sobriety, I still continued to work in restaurants and nightclubs. Now, I had a huge support system. I had lots of, what's so great about this program. And also, I should say thank you for letting me speak to you guys, because this is really a nice group. It really is. My friend who came with me, we were talking about what a nice group this is. And we've enjoyed it so far. But so I just lost my thought. So when you get old, it gets like that. So anyway, well, I'll go on to something else. So anyway, well, talking about having to give up everything, like I thought I had to give up my life. Okay, when I got to the place where I knew that I was an alcoholic, that I couldn't stop drinking on my own, it was very, very scary. That's the jumping off place. But God, it was so freeing, because I believed that other people believed that there was a way to be living soberly, because I had seen it in two people. And I believed, because they shared about that they had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step program, and they were socializing with me at my barbecue at my house, or coming actually into one of the places that I was working and giving and supporting me. So and having fun, because that was for me. It was like, how can I like rent a movie and not drink? And it sounds so silly, but it was like, how am I going to do that? How am I going to play a board game and not drink with my, you know, comrades? You know, or go to a wedding? I got invited one time to a sober wedding. I didn't go. I know, do any of you guys relate to that? How can I not go? God, talk about the prison that was being shared earlier. So anyway, like I said, it was kind of a freeing place, and I didn't win the lottery. And so I couldn't check myself into rehab. And that year in 1994, I had gone, my last drink was, I had dinner, so I ate some food, and I was drinking what I normally drank, and then I mixed stuff. Later on, I went out to a club or a bar, but I crossed over that line that they talk about in the big book, because I reacted much differently. I definitely fell into a sicker. I was waking up some mornings so sick already. That had been happening for years. And I crossed the line, because that night I was, my friend was driving, and I was going in and out of blackouts, and I was hanging my head out of the window, panting for air like a dog. So sick. And the next day, I don't even know what time it was. I know it was before 1 o'clock, because I got to a meeting, my first meeting, and I got there. I actually drove, but I woke up with triple vision. I heard a voice. I heard a voice that morning, and sometimes you know how you can hear a voice and you know it's like your own voice, and sometimes you hear voices and you don't know who it is, but it's not you. Well, I heard this voice, and it wasn't me, and it was very just firm. It was, go to AA. That was it. That's the voice I heard. Go to AA. And I was immediately, as I'm laying in the bed, going, you know, what? Go to AA. You know, I find the phone, barely, and I call 911, 411, 411. They pass me through to AA. I said, I need AA. They passed me through, and they told me where a meeting was, and I showed up, I drove myself there. So it was a 1 o'clock meeting at Howe Hall in Huntington Beach. And I showed up, and there were 4 people there. There was a very, 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 very old woman. Very, very old. I didn't even know she was really old. Alive. And so I believe she alive. Because she was... Okay, and then there was this guy with long blonde hair and a halo on. He had like broken his neck and he had the halo on. Oh, sorry. And he's just looking at me like this. Like he knows reading my mail. Then there was this really, she was about 40. I was 33 at the time. 40-ish. Tough former gang chick. Really tough with a mouth, woo, you know, and then this 18-year-old kid with speed polyps all over his face, and moi. And I'm like, I say this all the time, I'm looking around going, this was not part of my script. This was not part of my plan in life, you know. And when I share this, I talk about, I don't know what was said that day. I can't tell you what was, I can remember the guy, I was just going, with the halo, okay? So I definitely, he knew my story, or whatever, but that was the first day, and I've been going every day since. So whatever those 4 people said that day, you know, I was ready to receive the message. I had already known to, you know, confess to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I could not stop drinking on my own. And then whatever they said, boy, it stuck, you know. And that was actually, that day was January 22nd, 1994. My sobriety date is February 5th because on February 4th, a couple of weeks later, I smoked pot. I didn't know that you were supposed to kind of clean it up on all ends, you know. But at least I got to see that day, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, the last day I ever smoked pot, which was a great way to go out. Oh man, talk about laughing on the last day of that. I want to get to, I was thinking about when I was here, it's like, okay, so there's this little bit of the drunk log I just want to talk about, especially just in the last 10 or 12 minutes, the promises. And also losing the obsession to drink. Because see, that was the thing for me. I wish, you know, I got here when I was supposed to get here. Maybe if I had heard earlier that when you do this program, and you work these steps to the best ability, the best of your ability, the obsession to drink is lifted supernaturally. Because, see, I thought it would have to be about white-knuckling it the whole time. I did not know at the time this was a spiritual program. I didn't know that we, as a result of the steps, are getting a psychic change of a spiritual nature, and that's what happens to us. And this whole program, the steps, are designed to let us have a spiritual awakening that we change our character. Alcoholics, it says, are undisciplined to the core. Also, it talks about how we are actually very creative. Our intelligence is usually above many's, the average. Also talks about how, believe it or not, at some point we have more of a moral compass because we have so much guilt and for what we've done that we bury with booze, and then, of course, we become lousy, self-centered louses after that, right? But, so all this positive stuff, and but I was like, okay, well, none of that's going to be able to happen for me if I can't stop wanting the drink. So what happened to me with wanting the drink was, you know, I drank every day. I drank over pain and hurt and fear, and on Sundays I couldn't drink anymore because I was so sick for drinking for 7 days. So on Sundays I ate. That was the day I recovered and watched TV all day and got to eat. And so Monday would come around, and so Monday it'd be, okay, I'm going to try to get through Monday without having a drink. I like to start drinking around, well, any time really, but I'd clean the house and start romancing the wine, you know, at 4 o'clock, and then I would, you know, love to, typical, you know, cook the dinner, but it was, you know, it took 6 hours to prepare, you know. Then, because you're too busy having the cocktail party in front of it, you know, and so 4 o'clock, okay, I just don't want to drink, okay, I'm not drinking, it's 4 o'clock, oh my God, it's 5 o'clock, I haven't gone to the store. I'm not drinking. 5 o'clock. This is great. Great. This is great. Okay. 6 o'clock. 6, 6, 7. Now it's 7 o'clock. Oh my God. Maybe I'm going to get through this night not drinking. 7 o'clock. 8. Okay. It's 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock. Ooh, I get a little, let me go get another bag of potato chips. Okay. Ooh. All right. I'm not drinking. 8 o'clock. All right. God, I think I can do it. I think I can get through this night. I was so insane by 10 o'clock. I'm at the liquor store getting a bottle. I mean, so that told me that I was not free from the obsession. Okay, so that was my thought of what it was going to be. That's all I knew about not drinking, so I thought that's what my life was going to be like, not drinking. Until I was so desperate that I came in to the program, and they talked about the steps. And this one is, because it happened for me exactly like it talks in the big book here, I wanted to read it for you. In chapter 6, when it's talking about into action, and it talks about the fifth step. Okay, so I came into the program on the second. I had the second step down. I knew that I was powerless. You know, a power greater than myself was going to have to restore me to sanity. So I actually came in on the third step. I had first step down. I knew I was an alcoholic. Thank God. That was freeing. That was freeing. Okay, now what do we do about it? Okay, so when I did my fifth step, so much anguish and pain from my childhood and this beautiful, beautiful mother that I adored and loved so much and ripped out of my life, sick my whole life. And so I actually flew back, and my house that I grew up in with my mother after she died, and then 2 years later my father, he sold the house. He sold it to some weird guy that never moved in. So it sat there as the haunted house of the street for 28 years. And you couldn't go in, and I'd sit at the top of the street. I had these nightmares all the time that my mother was trapped in there and everything. So when I finally did my fifth step, I did it with my neighbor who was in the program back there. And I sat at the top of my street and did my fifth step, looking down at the house that had my beloved mother in it that I couldn't go in, that was looking like something out of a Stephen King novel now. So there was a lot of anger about that, you know. And it says right here, it says, when you do the fifth step, it says we have to do it. It says, first of all, the best reason is first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. So for those, if there's anybody in the room, a chronic relapser, and you haven't done the fourth and fifth step, that could be your issue. Because it says if we skip the fifth step, even if there's painful stuff, I know some of us have maybe vehicular manslaughter, some of us in here maybe have lost their children, lots of stuff that we don't want to feel, that we don't want to confess to others. And confession is just sharing the junk. That's the cleaning house of the program. If we skip that step, we may never overcome drinking. It tells us that. And then here, my experience was, because we pocket our pride and we go to it. It's talking about the fifth step. Illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease, which was my experience as I was crying while I was doing it, right? Getting all the gunk out. But afterwards, it was like, oh my gosh. Our fears fall from us. It says our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. And then this was totally my experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come on strongly. I'll say that again for those. I know a lot of you have read this, but maybe some of you haven't. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come on strongly. My obsession to drink was lifted after the fifth step. So, and then it says, we feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Once I did the fifth step, I didn't have any obsession of the mind to take another drink. And like I did that at like 7 months. I was 7 months. I was pouring 600 drinks a night bartending. On pouring drinks bartending, 500-600 drinks a night, with a desperately aching broken heart, because the marriage I was in, once I got in the program, he just failed. So I did a lot of meetings. I called a lot of alcoholics. I also went to church. I needed the double sore. I needed, you know, I needed program and I needed church. And, you know, I God forbid relapse is not my story, and I hope it never is part of my story. And I am at the point now where I say in the morning, God, please don't ever let me forget I'm an alcoholic, and please don't ever let me take another drink one day at a time for the rest of my life. Because in the beginning it was, let's just please don't let me take a drink this next hour. And I couldn't think. That's what I like about one day at a time, one hour at a time, because you don't have to think about the rest of your life. But now that I know that after I do the fifth step, the obsession to drink, just just wanting the drink is supernaturally lifted. And the word supernatural, super or supra is beyond. Natural is nature. It tells us when we in our readings in the beginning that no human power could relieve our alcoholism, so it has to come from beyond nature. And so that was my experience. And so these 17 and a half will be 18 years in February, I have had the character change. It's turned me into a person who is a lot more thoughtful for others than I ever used to be. And just in 4 minutes, I want to tell you the promises that happened. So I eventually got to get out of that the nightclub work. Well, not with the music at the time, but the restaurant work, because I actually could suit up and show up and go to college. So I went back to college and got my teaching credential because I could do it. Because now I'm sober, I can do what I want to do. We all can. You just suit up and show up. So I got my teaching credential at 40. Then I got a job in a great school. I didn't know why I got the job in the great school. I thought it was just for me because I was so lucky to get a job in the great school until I realized that in 2006, my husband and I, who was in this program, I met my husband in this program, my current husband, we decided to think outside of ourselves for the first time in our lives, and we adopted a little boy who was 10 years old from the foster system, who had been terribly abused, and his birth mother had gone to prison for a life sentence for the abuse, and there, for the grace of God, go I. Now I know why I got a job at this excellent Blue Ribbon school. It was not for me. It was because he could have the woman that's sitting right here, who's my friend in the program, as his teacher to get him back on the road because he had missed so much school in his life and he was so failing. And she was in program and she got to practice the principles in all of her affairs as well. And then he got to go to the school and he got to get caught up, kind of, still not quite caught up. He's 15 and a half now. I got to see him, go from living in a hovel in the desert, out in Yucca Valley, just dirty, just with, gloomy breakdowns, thinking he was stupid and all that, to being on the water polo team, and being an actor and getting the lead in the school play, and because that's the program. That's the promises. Those things can happen. I love what you shared about your children and everything like that. So, and he knows we're in program. And we talk about drugs and alcohol all the time. And he said to me, and with this, because he doesn't see it in the household, I said to him, I go, sweetie, I really, really hope that you don't, try drugs or alcohol because it's just Russian roulette. You're such at risk, so at risk. And he looked at me, he goes, Mom, my birth mother went to prison and my brother died of drugs. It's because his brother died of a drug overdose at 14. He goes, so he's seen it, drugs and alcohol. So I feel pretty good that he's a product of Alcoholics Anonymous, I feel pretty good that he's going to be okay because he's just, I'm just the steward. I practice principles all my affair. He belongs to God. So, anyway, thank you for letting me share with you guys, and thank you for calling me Jordan, and God bless you guys.